Jacob and Laban confirm their bargain. An articulation, a sort of epoch in Jacob's sojourn, came about through the fact that the contract which he signed with Laban on the day after his arrival was voided after only a single month and replaced by another, much more binding one. The uncle had taken immediate steps to give legal sanction to Jacob's position in his house, as he had conceived it in his dry and materialistic communings over his beer. They set off early from the steading and betook themselves on asses to the town of Haran, Laban, Jacob, and the slave Abdsheba, the last named having to serve as witness before the notary or officer of the law. This officer had his seat set up in a court, where there was a great press of people, all come hither to execute or to contest contracts, buyers and sellers, lessors and lessees, couples to be married and to be divorced. The justice and his two clerks who squatted beside him had their hands full to satisfy the claims of the town and country population, and Laban and his people had to wait a long time until it was the turn of their, after all, insignificant and quickly dispatched affair. Laban had first to find a bystander, several stood about in hope of such windfalls, and to pay him with corn and oil to act as second witness. This man, then, with Abdsheba, became guarantee for the contract, and both sealed to it by pressing their thumbnails into the convex reverse of the clay tablet. Laban possessed a cylindrical seal. Jacob had forfeited his, and so sealed with the hem of his garment. Thus they attested the simple text, scratched down by one of the scribes to the mechanical dictation of the judge. Laban, sheep-breeder, took this and this man from Amuru land, being homeless, son of this and this man, as hired servant, until further notice. Said man, obliging himself to devote his powers of body and mind in the service of Laban's house and business, with no other pay than the satisfaction of his bodily needs. Qualification, appeal, complaint, there were none. Whoever might, contrary to law, in future impugn this contract, and seek to challenge it, his suit should be no suit, and he should be fined 5 minas of silver. That was all. Laban had to pay the charges, and did so with a couple of copper plaques which he threw grumbling onto the scales. But actually, it was cheap at the price to bind Jacob over on such terms, for he set more store by the blessing than he had been willing to confess, and it would be to underestimate his business sagacity to assume that he was not aware of the good bargain he had made. He was a depressing man, and unpleasing in the sight of the gods, without confidence in his own star, and hence unsuccessful so far in his undertakings. He did not for a moment fail to recognize that he could do excellently well with a blessing-bearing man as a partner. Thus, after the contract was signed, he was in good spirits, for him, and indulged in a little shopping, buying food, stuffs, and small equipment, and challenging his companions to express their admiration of the city and its noisy traffic. The thickness of the walls and bastions, and the beauty of the well-watered gardens surrounding them, where garlands of vine hung between the date palms. The sacred splendors of Ehulhul, the walled temple, whose courts had gates plated with silver and guarded by bronze bulls. The loftiness of the tower rising in graduated steps on its immense mound, surrounded by ramparts, a monstrosity erected of tiles in 7 different colors, the top being azure blue, so that the shrine and temporary quarters of the god where his marriage bed was set up melted into the brilliant blue of the upper air. But Jacob had only hum and ha to say to these sights. The urban did not speak to him. He loved neither the bustle and tumult, nor the exaggerated gorgeousness of the buildings, which gave themselves the airs of the eternal, but in his view were destined to destruction within a term which in God's sight was very trifling indeed. And that, no matter how cleverly the brick mountain was drained and protected by bitumen and reed mats. He was homesick for the meadows of Beersheba. But by contrast with the pretentious splendors of the town, which oppressed his shepherd's soul, he could almost think of Laban's farm as home, where there waited for him a pair of black eyes, in whose expression he had read utter readiness, with which he felt important matters were to be discussed. He thought of her as he absently regarded these doomed and presumptuous structures, of her and of his God, who had promised to keep his feet in strange places and to lead him rich home, the God of Abram, for whom he felt jealous as he looked at Bel-Haran's house and court, this fortress of an idolatrous faith, guarded by bronze griffins and wild bulls, in whose inmost cell, sparkling with precious stones and built of gilded cedar beams, the bearded statue of the idol stood on a silver pedestal and received the smoke and incense and adoration of a regally developed ritual. Whereas Jacob's God, whom he felt was greater than all others, even to being the only God, possessed no house at all upon earth, and was worshipped in simplicity under trees and on heights of ground. Doubtless he would not have it otherwise, and Jacob felt proud that he had scorned and despised such earthly and urban splendors because they would not have done him enough honor. But in his pride there mingled some suspicion that even his God would have liked to live in an enameled house with beams of cedar and adorned with carbuncles, which of course would have to be 7 times finer than the house of the moon idol, and only resigned it because his people were not yet powerful enough to build it for him. Only wait, Jacob thought, and boast your uttermost of the splendors of your high lord Bel. Me hath my God at Bethel promised to make rich those who believe in him. And when we are rich, we will build to him a house of pure gold and sapphire, rock crystal and jasper, within and without, so that the houses of all your gods and goddesses shall pale before it. Awful is the past, and the present mighty, for that it is present to the eye. But greatest and holiest is beyond doubt the future, and consoling to the oppressed heart of him to whom it is promised. Of Jacob's expectancy. Late as it was when uncle and nephew returned from the town, Laban insisted on putting the tablet with the contract into the chamber in the cellar of his house, which served for the deposit of such documents. Jacob went with him, each with a lighted lamp in his hand. The chamber lay beneath the floor of the left-hand room, opposite the gallery where they had taken yesterday's meal. It was a sort of archive, combined with a chapel and a burial place, for Bethuel's bones reposed here in the center in an earthen chest, surrounded by vessels and food offerings and tripods with pans for the burning. And somewhere here, too, deeper down or within a side wall, must be the jar with the remains of Laban's sacrificed little son. There was a niche at the back of the cellar with a square brick altar before it, and along the sides ran low, narrow benches. On the right-hand one lay various tablets, receipts, accounts, and contracts, put here for safekeeping. But on the opposite bench stood some 10 or 12 little gods, curious to behold, some with high caps and the faces of bearded children, others bald and beardless, with skirts like scales and bare upper parts, holding their hands folded peacefully under their chins. Others had coarsely modeled garments falling in folds, the plump toes sticking out beneath. These were Laban's household gods and little soothsayers, his teraphim, in whom he reposed great confidence and was wont to consult them upon every occasion of moment. They protected the house, he explained to Jacob. They were fairly reliable weather prophets, advised him in matters of buying and selling, indicated the direction in which a lost sheep might have strayed, and so on. Jacob did not relish the bones, the receipt tablets, nor the idols, and was glad when they had reascended the ladder that led down to their domains through a hole in the floor, and he could go to sleep. Laban had worshipped before Bethuel's coffin, changing the water which was there for the refreshment of the deceased, poured out water to him, and made his obeisances to the teraphim. It only lacked that he should have worshipped the documents. Worship of the dead and adoration of idols were alike repugnant to Jacob. He was depressed by the confusion and lack of clarity that reigned in this house in religious matters. One would have expected a much more enlightened attitude in Laban, who, after all, was Rebekah's brother and the grand-nephew of Abram. He was not without knowledge of the religious tradition of his relatives in the West, but so much local observance mingled with his original convictions that it formed now their main content, to which the Abrahamitic contribution was only subsidiary. Seated though he was at the very source and fount of the spiritual history of his tribe, and perhaps because he had remained seated there, he regarded himself entirely as a subject of Babel, and adherent to its state religion, speaking to Jacob of Yah Elohim, the God of thy fathers, and mixing him up quite ridiculously with Marduk, the god of Shinar. That upset Jacob. He had expected a more enlightened culture, as his father and mother had obviously done too, and particularly on Rachel's account he was disquieted, for of course her beautiful and well-favored little head must suffer from equal confusion. He took every occasion from then on to influence her in the direction of the true and just God. For from the first day, indeed from the moment he had seen her at the fountain, he thought of her as his bride. And it is probably not too much to say that she too, in the little cry which escaped her when she was convinced of his cousinship, acknowledged him as her bridegroom. Marriage between relatives was at that time, for excellent reasons, quite the usual thing. It was the only proper, sensible, and respectable arrangement. We know how poor Esau damaged his position by his eccentric marriages. It was no personal crotchet of Abram's which caused him to insist that Yitzhak, the true son, should take a wife only from his race and his father's house, that is, from Nahor's house at Haran, in order that one might know what one was getting. In coming to this house of marriageable daughters, Jacob was treading in the footsteps of Isaac, or, more precisely, in Eliezer's, and the idea of marriage was for him, as well as for Isaac and Rebekah, bound up with the visit. As indeed it would also have been for Laban, had the man of business been able at once to recognize a son-in-law in this fugitive and beggar. Laban, like any other father, would have found dangerous and repugnant the idea of giving his daughters into a strange and unknown race, to sell them, as he would have put it, abroad. Far wiser and more fitting it was for them to remain, as married women, within the bosom of the tribe, and a cousin on the father's side being available, he, that is to say Jacob, was the natural and foreordained husband for them, which meant not only for one of them, but for both. Such was the tacit, general assumption in Laban's house when Jacob came. And certainly it was Rachel's. She it was who had first greeted the newcomer, and she understood her role on this earth quite well enough to know that she was beautiful and well-favored, whereas Leah had tender eyes. Yet in that open-hearted, measuring gaze she had given Jacob at the well, she was by no means thinking of herself alone. Life would have it that the coming of their cousin made rivals of the sisters and playmates, but not in regard to the decisive question of whom he would choose. It might indeed rest with her to use her greater attractiveness to the advantage of them both. No, it would be later that a question would arise, the question as to which of them would make a better, more capable, fruitful, and beloved wife to the cousin husband, a matter in which she had no advantage, and which did not depend on a more or less ephemeral power of attraction. Such was the attitude in Laban's house, and only Jacob himself, and this was the cause of much misunderstanding, looked at things differently. For in the first place, though he knew that besides the lawful wife, one could have concubines and slaves who bore one half-legitimate children, he was not aware, and did not learn for a long time, that in this region, and particularly in Haran and roundabout, marriage with two equally legitimate wives was not only frequent, but in well-to-do families even customary. And in the second place, his heart and senses were too full of Rachel's charms even to spend a thought upon the somewhat older, more mature, and ill-favored sister. Even when he spoke to her out of politeness, he was not thinking of her, and she knew it, and smiled bitterly, shrouding in dignity the pain at her heart, and drooping her eyelids to hide her squint. Laban saw it too, and was jealous for his eldest born, rejoicing for her neglected sake that he had reduced the cousin suitor to the legal status of a hired slave.